So this reading today is taken from Luke chapter 9, verses 28 to 36. About 8 days after Jesus said this, he took Peter, John, and James with him and went up onto a mountain to pray. As he was praying, the appearance of his face changed, and his clothes became as bright as a flash of lightning. Two men, Moses and Elijah, appeared in glorious splendor, talking with Jesus. They spoke about his departure, which he was about to bring to fulfillment at Jerusalem. Peter and his companions were very sleepy, but when they became fully awake, they saw his glory and the two men standing with him. As the men were leaving Jesus, Peter said to him, "Master, it is good for us to be here. Let us put up three shelters, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah." He did not know what he was saying. While he was speaking, a cloud appeared and covered them, and they were afraid as they entered the cloud. A voice came from the cloud saying, "This is my son whom I have chosen. Listen to him." When the voice had spoken, they found that Jesus was alone. The disciples kept this to themselves and did not tell anyone at that time what they had seen.
The shock came before COVID. In the middle of the Brexit debate, and to understand it, you've got to go back many decades to when I was at school. And I had a friend at school called Boris. That wasn't his name. Well, he was from Polish stock. His father was a carpenter and a builder who came over. And in fact, Boris didn't speak English till he started school. His name was Borisiewicz, I think, if I can pronounce it correctly, but nobody could pronounce it. And Boris didn't care. He was just Boris. Teachers called him Boris. Friends called him Boris. Colleagues called him Boris. He was just Boris. He was happy to be Boris. Down in the stands at Cardiff City, where he was a keen supporter of Cardiff City, everyone called him Boris. He's a lovely boy, lovely lad, gentle, kind, nice humour, welcoming smile, gorgeous smile, nice guy, but not outstanding. And we were in a group of which had at its head this super group of super talented pupils who all got scholarships to Oxford and exhibitions to Oxford and everything. And then there was the rest of us. And in fact, in the rest of us, I was at the bottom of the rest of us, just in case you're wondering. But Boris never hit the elite. He never stood out. He was just a nice guy, a nice boy. Everyone loved him. Nobody had a bad word to say about him. But he didn't stand out. And he didn't go to Oxford or Cambridge. He didn't want to. His ambition was to go to Cardiff University and read medicine, which he did, along with one of the other from that group. And along he went. And a couple of years after we'd also started university, 2 or 3 years later, we had a reunion. Boris wasn't there, but the other lad who was reading medicine was. And he said, "The revelation is Boris." He said, "I don't know what's happened, but Boris is at the top of every class. Boris is winning all the prizes. Boris is absolutely shining. You won't believe the transformation in that man." I was okay, fair enough. That was nice to know. It was good to know, because you couldn't begrudge Boris, a lovely guy. And that was it. I heard nothing more of Boris for over 40 years. And it was during the Brexit debate, they were arguing about the effect Brexit would have on scientific research and medical research in Britain. And suddenly, there, in the corner of my lounge on my television screen, was Boris. Same smile, same gentle sense of humour, same just welcoming personality, same guy, but no longer Boris. He was now on the screen, just brace yourselves for this. He was now Professor Sir Borisiewicz, Vice Chancellor of Cambridge University, Chair of the British Medical Research Council. I'm thinking, what? What? And there he was. That quiet guy I'd sat next to in chemistry all through sixth form was now the leading scientist in the United Kingdom. And I was talking to one of my friends I go walking with, this retired professor of medicine. I was telling him this story, and he doubled up laughing. He said, oh, Boris, we all know Boris. And apparently he's still called Boris. Everyone still calls him Boris. And he still supports Cardiff City. But he has just turned into this giant of... he's retired now from Cambridge University, by the way. He's just retired a couple of years ago. But you can Google him. He's there. And he is just a great guy. You suddenly realize that the person you thought you knew, you didn't know. You didn't know. There was just something there that escaped you somehow. And certainly, none. I can assure you, we spent 2 years together in that chemistry lab, but none of us saw that one coming. And no one deserves it more, by the way. If you want to find out why he was given the knighthood, it's all there on Google. And so I just want to say two things this morning, because I'm not going to repeat the story of Jesus on the Mount of Transfiguration. We've just read it together. You've heard the story. But what does it mean? Well, I just bring two things out of it this morning. The first is this. I just want to say, wake up and sense the glory. Verse 22 says, I love this translation, when they were fully awake. Well, you know, they're up there on the mountain and Jesus is off on one again praying, whatever. And what do we do now, guys? Well, you know, they probably say, how about a time of silent prayer? What a good idea. I don't know about you, but give me eyes shut, time of silent prayer. I'm asleep within 30 seconds. I'm not alone. I'm sure I'm not, Andrew. And so there's so much humour, actually. In it. Luke writes with a lot of humour, but we're too serious to pick it up most of the time. But, you know, they're just drifting off. They're gone. And then suddenly, Moses and Elijah appear, and there's Jesus transformed before them. And they're just going to miss the glory. When I was a little boy, my parents took us on a holiday to Lake Garda in Italy. And one day I took ill with some kind of tummy thing, and I really wasn't very well. But there was a firework display, the end of the week firework display that night. And I wanted to see it, but I was really very poorly. So they said, it's all right, Peter, we'll wake you up when the fireworks start and you can see them from the window. Which they did. And they woke me up, watched the fireworks from the window, put me back to bed, and the next day they said, did you enjoy the fireworks? And I couldn't remember seeing the fireworks at all. To this day, I don't remember the fireworks. And you can miss the glory, you know, you can miss the bangs and the whizzes. You can just miss something because you're not connected. Many a preacher, I'm not the first, and I won't be the last to use this. It's quite often used by preachers in sermons on this passage. I tell the story of two great poets from the beginning of the 19th century, Coleridge and Shelley. And they had two different approaches to a mountain, Chamonix in Switzerland. A mountain, again, my parents took me to when I was young and went up on a cable car. It's fantastic, just astonishing. But in 1802, Samuel Taylor Coleridge, who was one of the romantic poets, wrote this about the mountain of Chamonix. O dread and silent mount, I gazed upon thee till thou, still present to the bodily sense, did vanish from my thought. Entranced in prayer, I worshipped the invisible alone. From his poem Hymn Before Sunset, which says, awake my soul. And that was the romantic poet's view of this mountain. The mountain disappears and all he sees is the presence of the God who created it. And he's overwhelmed by this spirit within nature, this power of the creator God, the invisible. And he's overcome by it. 14 years later, Percy Shelley visited the Hotel de Londres in Chamonix, and he wrote this in the visitor's book. Percy Shelley, lover of humanity, democrat, atheist. And many, they said, you know, one saw the glory and the other just didn't get it. One saw a nice mountain, the other saw God. And you can both look on the same thing, and one of you can miss the glory. One of you can miss the wonder. Something wonderful and you're happening, and you're missing it. Bob Dylan, during his religious phase, wrote a song called Who Turned the Lights On? And that's how it can be, you know? Suddenly, God is there. And the glory shines, and you hadn't seen it before. You weren't fully awake. The glory and the wonder of Jesus is revealed. And the disciples just almost missed it. They were almost asleep. Can you imagine sleeping through that one? I mean, really, you'd kick yourself, wouldn't you? Anyway, so my first thing this morning, wake up and sense the glory of Jesus, because it's there. And the second thing is this, make sense of the glory. It's one thing to see the glory, it's another to make sense of it. You can miss what it actually means. Those of you who know me know and were bored to death by me using artistic examples in my sermons, but I like going to art galleries. And many years ago, there was an exhibition of Kandinsky on at the Tate Modern, and I won't show you a picture because you'd just be distracted from what I'm saying, and they're quite difficult to understand, Kandinsky. He was very abstract. Painter. And he believed that colors and shapes can change our emotion, can alter emotion. And before you laugh at that, try walking around a supermarket and asking you why the orange juice have orange circles on. And that's all been worked out by psychologists. They actually have fake supermarkets with different packaging. There's nothing in the packets. And they send people around with trolleys to choose which orange juice they do. And they see whether it's square, orange squares, orange circles, or orange ovals that attracts people. And that's what goes on the packet. This entire industry based on what Kandinsky discovered 100 years ago, which is that shapes and colors can move us and transform us. But there was more to Kandinsky than that, because he believed there was a harmony in nature. And he, in his paintings, he tried to create harmony between one side of a painting and the other to somehow get to the spirit, the sense of life, the joy and the wonder of life behind the colors and the shapes. So if you're going to understand Kandinsky, you've got to stand quite a time in front of one of his paintings and think about it. Sometimes you get it. Sometimes, believe me, you don't. But you've got to try. So I was in this, I'd paid to go to this exhibition of Kandinsky. He's a prolific painter. So there's loads of paintings, walls after walls of paintings come from all over Europe and America on the walls. And I was watching, and there was this lad, I think he was Chinese, but I'm not sure. I'm not sure of his nationality. And he was obviously on a tight time schedule. And we can all sympathize with that. We've all been there. But he paid to go into this exhibition. But he didn't have time to stand in front of the paintings and think about it. So he just had his iPhone. And he clicked the first one, and he would literally run to the second one, click it, run to the third. He went down the entire exhibition running between the paintings, clicking them on his iPhone, disappearing out the door at the back. And I was thinking, what was the point of that? I also thought the poor people are going to have to be shown all these paintings. Anyway, you know, you'll get home and be looking at the painting on this little iPhone, and he won't get any of it. I absolutely 100% sure he didn't catch anything of those paintings. He never made sense of what he was seeing. And the disciples are struggling to make sense of what they see. Esther van der Waal, the theologian, says that sometimes we're like people who go around art galleries, and that we can be like people who look at the little plaques. But do you do that? You go to an art gallery. You've got the painting in front of you. There's Van Gogh, you know. But you're not looking at Van Gogh. You're looking, or Van Gogh, isn't it? You've got to pronounce it these days. I'm outdated. I'm just an old dinosaur. You're looking at this Van Gogh painting. But you're not actually, you're actually reading the plaque that says Starry Night, Van Gogh painted such and such. You actually don't take the picture in. You just kind of trying to write the plaque or make sense of it. And if I'd written that plaque, I'd written something else on it. I mean, you miss the wonder of the art that we're seeing. And the disciples, they see Jesus in his glory. They've woken up to actually see it. And now they've got to make sense of it. And this is where it all goes wrong. Again. There was, some theologians think, a belief that when the Messiah came, it would be during the Feast of the Tabernacles. And that, they think, was based on Zechariah chapter 14 and verse 16, which says, "Then the survivors from all the nations that have attacked Jerusalem will go up year after year to worship the King, the Lord Almighty, and to celebrate the Festival of Tabernacles." And some people had in their mind fixed Feast of Tabernacles and the Messiah. And they think that may have been behind what Peter says, which was, I tell you what, why don't we make three tabernacles here? One for Jesus, one for Elijah, and one for Moses. And Luke makes the humorous comment, and you're supposed to laugh, but he didn't know what he was saying. Well, we don't laugh because we take it all too seriously. We miss the humor in the Bible. But here is Peter just blundering. He's only just woken up when he should have been awake in the first place. And now he's saying, well, I'll tell you what, let's celebrate the Feast of Tabernacles. That's not what it's about, Peter. That isn't what this is going on for. And making sense of that was difficult for them. I think that there's a theologian called Malcolm Talbot, and his suggestion I like. He says, look, the point here, surely, is resurrection. Jesus has been talking, telling his disciples, off and on, through his ministry, that he is destined to die and rise again on the third day. That's his teaching. And they don't understand it. They don't get it. They're not even sure if they believe it. Okay? Now, just before this happens, they have witnessed, they have seen a 12-year-old girl who was dead, taken by the hand by Jesus and raised from her bed and get up and demands and complain that she's hungry. They have watched a resurrection with their own eyes, the same three disciples, by the way, same three. That's where the connection is. That's what it's about. Same three disciples in that room, just with the mum and dad and Jesus, watched the daughter of Jairus raised from the dead. Now they're here on the mountain, and there's Moses and Elijah, and in case it hasn't escaped their attention, Moses and Elijah are supposed to be dead. Like, you know, 2,000 years dead almost, 1,500 years dead. And they're seeing them. And there's a resurrection theme here. This is another lesson in the power of resurrection and the glory of resurrection to them. And they are nowhere near understanding it. There is an eternity unfolding before them, and they don't get it. Later on in this chapter, Jesus is going on to complain about this unbelieving and perverse generation. And the prime example up there on the mountain with him, the three disciples, we just don't get that the resurrection will happen. And then comes that voice, this is my beloved son. This is my beloved son. And it's there. The Son of God coming to earth, dying on the cross and being raised from the dead. That's the secret that's at the heart of this planet. As it happens. That is the whole story of planet Earth, really. The key point, the key moment, the Son of God walks this earth, is crucified, and rises from the dead in glory. And I don't know about you, I often feel I'm just sleepwalking through life sometimes. I miss the connecting link between one part of my life and the next. So I'm walking along the prom there in Horsensee one moment. I'm sitting playing a guitar in my study the next. I'm meeting some friends for coffee the next. I'm worshiping in church, maybe leading a service in church. But somehow I don't connect the whole spread of my life. When really this passage is saying, Peter, the whole of your life is connected to this. It's the glory of Jesus that one day will be revealed. It's all about the death and resurrection of Jesus, dying on the cross for you and being raised from the dead. That is the connecting thread of your life from childhood to death and beyond death to resurrection and seeing Jesus in his glory. When I was as a child, my parents were Anglicans. And a few times a year, they take me to Llandaff Cathedral. And I was just about 10, and I was bored to tears. I mean, I was seriously bored. I remember being very bored by those services. But one thing fascinated me was, if you've ever been to Cardiff, and have you anybody here been to Llandaff Cathedral? Hands up, a few of you. There is something in that cathedral that is totally overpowering. Yeah, you know what I'm going to talk about. Because if you walk into that cathedral, or if you're a 10-year-old child, you're sat in there for, it seems like hours on end, what attracts your attention, what overpowers you, is what's coming on the screen now. It's a massive statue of Christ in Majesty by Epstein, the sculptor. Now, I'm not a fan of statues in churches. Never have been, never will be. Not my style, not my thing. I struggle with it. But I can tell you, as a 10-year-old child, that statue kept my attention for hour upon hour in that cathedral. I forget everything else, but I remember that statue of Christ in Majesty. It's called, my parents said, Peter, that's the Majestus, and it's by Epstein. I'd never heard of Epstein before. I've seen many of his sculptures since, and they're amazing. But that's the Majestus, that's Christ in glory. And believe me, when you're a 10-year-old sat in front of that phenomenal piece of art, it really is overpowering. And it overshadowed that service. In fact, it seems, looking back, like it overshadowed my childhood, but in a good way. It was going to be years before I had a full encounter with Jesus properly in my life, by the way. But up to that point, my encounter came through just that image of Jesus in glory. And I think, you know, there are worse images to have in your mind than that. Because our aim in life is not a little talk with Jesus. Our aim in life is to see Jesus when he is revealed in his glory. And that is where our life is headed. That is what we want to see. That is what we want to know. And yet, there's a lot to happen before then. But what this passage is telling us is this. This is the meaning of our life. This is the destiny of our life. It is the glory, the wonder of Jesus, Son of God, crucified, resurrected, coming in glory, where we will meet him and worship him. And if you ask me what I want to see in life, most of all, it's not the Taj Mahal. It's not the Grand Canyon. It's not the Great Wall of China. It's not the Niagara Falls. It's not the Victoria Falls. What I want to see is the glory of Jesus revealed. If the band would just join me, please, on the platform. Let's bow our heads and pray. Father, it's going to be wonderful to be overshadowed and overpowered by the glory of Jesus. To fall at his feet and to just let his glory shine through our life. And we pray, Lord, that this glory might shine into our existence on this drizzly, overcast day in Bangor. Lord, be the thread which links every moment of this day, that the glory of Jesus, which is our destiny to see and to participate in, might overwhelm us, even in the quiet moments, even as we're drying dishes or hoovering the floor or going for a stroll or settling down in front of the television. Lord, may that glory of Jesus overshadow and shine into our lives. Amen.